This is Abundance. Every week I discuss one of the 1001 things I'm thankful for here on Abundance. My list of 1001 thanks includes things like raises, ramblings, and random acts of kindness, just to mention three topics found under R in my list of 1001 thanks. Today we'll examine potential. It's number 732. Listing things I am thankful for helps me remember I live in a provident, satisfying world, and you are one of the best things about it. Welcome to Abundance. A funny thing happened on the way to Dane Allred. Burned rice twice. I may be the world's laziest cook. I do know how to cook an omelet. I even took a cooking class in high school called Bachelor Survival. The only thing I remember cooking was chocolate mousse. And since no one in my group liked how it tasted, I ate 5 or 6 servings. I broke out in hives, had to stay home for a couple of days. I'm also cheap. I don't like to spend a lot for breakfast or lunch. Since I eat lunch at school, I tried cooking a plain potato for a while. Just a potato cooked in a microwave, but after a while that got kind of boring. About this time, I realized I probably needed to start eating breakfast more regularly, so here's the routine I find myself in nearly every day. I like to cook some oatmeal before school since it's only that only takes a couple of minutes. I really don't like milk, so I only put some maple syrup on it. Oatmeal is supposed to be good for lowering cholesterol, and it also counts as roughage, so I've done 2 good things as the day begins, and I do that every day. Continuing in the single food category, I cook brown rice at school. Brown rice takes a while for some reason, so this may be the extent of my culinary skills. 5 minutes on high, 45 on medium, and then I have a very filling lunch, which can be topped with a little salt or a little sugar. That's right. Nothing else on the rice. No milk, no spices, no nothing. The rice is another serving or two of roughage, and the argument I offer for rice every day for lunch is 3 billion people who eat rice for every meal can't be too wrong. Here's the really strange part of the breakfast and lunch scenario. I've gotten used to eating this every day, as in I've been eating oatmeal and rice every day for 3, 4, or 5 years now. I don't know how long it's been. I had to do a commercial. Some people make fun of the fact that I eat the same thing every breakfast and every lunch, but the good news about rice for lunch is it seems to keep me more awake in the afternoon, where I used to fade before I started that routine. The only problem with being so regular is that the habit sometimes overtakes the logic of what goes into such a simple meal. The following problem happened not just once, but twice. I thought it happened again the other day, but someone else was responsible that time. Here's what happened. Rice is simple. Shake in the hundreds of grains, fill it up with water, maybe add some salt, and start cooking. But remember, brown rice cooks for 50 minutes, 45 at medium, after 5 minutes on high. Now, the only time I really have problems with this simple recipe is when I get distracted. Usually, I'm talking with somebody else, or I have something else on my mind. So I'm trying to do 2 things at once, and since I don't want to be rude, somewhere in the conversation, I forget one of the steps. There's really no excuse, but at least twice I've tried to cook rice without any water. If you've never been blessed to smell rice cooked without water for 50 minutes, I can give you a few details to help you understand the smell. Think about toast completely burned through with some hints of coffee. I don't think there was any smoke, but everyone on that side of the building was sure there was a fire somewhere, but they just couldn't figure out where. It's the worst inside the microwave. I'm just glad it didn't start on fire. I could see the fire department pulling my plastic bowl of smoking rice out of the microwave and trying to identify who was the idiot who decided to fry rice today. Needless to say, the first time I burned rice, there was a general uproar about the fire, which was burning somewhere in the building. Imagine my surprise when I opened the microwave and saw a pile of dark brown burned something. I really wasn't smart enough to keep quiet about it, so everybody made fun of the fact that I couldn't even cook plain rice. They really enjoyed teasing me the second time I burned the rice. Now I'm paranoid. Sometimes I go back and I double check to make sure the bowl has rice and water. A couple of weeks ago, I smelled what I thought was burning rice, and I rushed to the microwave. I had remembered to add water that day, so I breathed a sigh of relief. Somewhere, someone was burning toast. And that's okay. As long as I don't get blamed for it. Dane Allred's World of Hurt. Hi Ho Silver. One of the most traumatic events of my youth occurred when I was 8 or 9. I'd been given my first horse, which was all mine. It was a gray Shetland pony who I think was named Flicka, but that may be just too much adolescent television talking. I think I may have tried to forget this particular pet's name subconsciously, and the why of that statement will become evident in a moment. I had experience with horses from when I was younger. I've been told that one night I was out in the barn while Dad was working on one of the horses. I walked too near the backside and received a complimentary kick across the barn. Apparently the horse caught me right in the chest, and since I couldn't have been more than 5 years old, I was promptly deposited against the nearest barn wall. Ouch. But back to the Shetland pony. This particular horse was not very nice. I remember being bit several times, even when trying to feed the stupid horse. I had hay fever, so I didn't have to worry about feeding the horse too much. My dad had other horses which he fed at the same time. I was allergic to the horse a bit, but it was still too much fun to ride to let that get in the way. After saddling up the mini saddle on the mini horse, I could pretend I was galloping through the Wild West. Mostly, though, I was galloping through my still-developing neighborhood. I did have the sniffles for a while after every ride, but it was glorious fun until the day we jumped the ditch. If you've never been on a horse, one of the important things to remember is that you often have to straighten your legs in the stirrups of the saddle, or you may wind up on the ground. This includes when the horse might buck, jump, or when the ride is just too rough. This is especially true when jumping ditches. We were tooling around the small fields, which hadn't been turned into building lots yet, and there was this small ditch which ran across the center of the fields. It was probably only a foot deep, but it was a serious enough jump for the small horse that I should have had the sense to stand up briefly in the stirrups to avoid getting dumped off the back. You guessed it. I bounced when the horse landed on the other side, fell off the back of the smallish horse, and continued to follow. My right foot was caught in the stirrup. This meant that the pony, which didn't like me all that much to begin with, was now dragging me across the fields, which contained various rocks, tall weeds, and other exciting stuff to scrape my back upon. My shirt had immediately shot up around my armpits, which made it difficult to try to reach up and disengage the boot from the stirrup. The brambles and the dirt were scraping up my back pretty well, and the stupid horse showed no sign of stopping. I don't know if the horse was enjoying the romp or was just scared since it was dragging this big weight behind it. It didn't seem to matter, which was the reason. The horse just kept running. Every once in a while, the horse slowed up a bit and I could try to reach my boot again. The worst news is that every time I got close to being able to get the boot out of the stirrup, the horse would kick me right in the forehead. I must have been kicked in the head 7 or 8 times. Ever since then, I felt I was destined to be a performer. Finally, the horse came too close to a home which was being built nearby and up in a neighborhood. Father was able to grab the reins and stop the mayhem. I sat up slowly and released my boot. I stood and pulled my shirt down my now scratched and bleeding back. I took the reins from the man who stood looking at me like an alien. Here was a kid who had been dragged across the field and had been kicked in the head several times. And I was still walking upright. Double ouch. I walked home very slowly, unsaddled the horse, and put it back in the pen. When I went inside, I told my mom I wanted to sell the horse. She took one look at me, and the horse was gone in a week. It almost makes me wish the urban myths about people who like to eat horse flesh were true. I don't hold that grudge anymore, but then I haven't ridden many horses lately. You're listening to Abundance. Today we're examining potential. It's number 732 on the list of 1001 things I'm thankful for. I hope you are living the life you want, a life of purpose on purpose. The abundance of opportunity is what we celebrate here. What an incredible time we live in. I can speak to people all over the world every week. I can find out what is happening anywhere in the world almost immediately. I also see an abundance of hope. I know we can find the path for everyone to thrive. You're listening to Abundance. This is Dane Allred. Today we're examining potential. I look forward to the day when all the people of the earth can live together in harmony, even with differing opinions, goals, and desires. When we respect the others we find living this life with us, we begin to realize we're all on this together. Abundance. Space. Potential by Dane Allred. You have unlimited potential. As an intelligence, you have existed forever. Deep down inside, you know this to be true. You were never created, but have always been. We were in that bright space together, our experiences shared, knowing all there was to know. We knew there was more possible, there was more we could achieve. But that meant leaving the bright space and all that we had ever known. That also meant we would forget all that we had ever known. We are here to learn all we can before we return to the bright space. We will all be together again. But until then, we are here to do something, that thing you are here to do, that inner potential you carry about with you that can help you accomplish those things you need to do. The prospect of what will be lives in you. We are pools of unlimited potential. When we see all that is possible for ourselves, when we consider all we could achieve, there is that promising glint of what could be, of what might be. Only you know what that is. Watch for that spark of familiarity next time you seem to recognize someone, that person you meet who it seems you have seen before. The person who you seem to have met before. Somewhere, some place. They may be here to help you accomplish that thing you need to do. Or you may just be recognizing someone you knew once from very long ago. As the universe shrinks and we find ourselves acquainted with those we were with before, the potential of the universe expands. When we work together now and learn all there is to learn, when we are all together again in that bright space, we will share all we have come to know, as only we could know, as we live our own individual lives, apart, and yet connected with all the power of the universe. There is nothing we cannot accomplish together. Together by Dane Allred. When I think of us together, I smile. There is something we are when we are in each other's company. Something that doesn't exist when we are apart. The two of us together make up more than two. We have a family, but those children aren't us. We have a home, but that home isn't us. When you reach out and take my hand, that is when we combine into one thought, one purpose. That is us.
Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 11 by William Shakespeare. As fast as thou shalt wane, so fast thou growest in one of thine from that which thou departest. And that fresh blood which youngly thou bestowest, thou mayest call thine when thou from youth convertest. Herein lives wisdom, beauty, and increase. Without this, folly, age, and cold decay. If all were minded so, the time should cease, and 80 years would make the world away. Let those whom nature hath not made for store, harsh, featureless, and rude, barrenly perish. Look, whom she best endowed, she gave the more, which bounteous gift thou shouldst in bounty cherish. She carved thee for her seal, and meant thereby thou shouldst print more. Not let that copy die. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 12 by William Shakespeare. When I do count the clock that tells the time and see the brave day sunk in hideous night, when I behold the violet past prime, and sable curls all silvered o'er with white, when lofty trees I see barren of leaves, which erst from heat did canopy the herd, and summer's green all girded up in sheaves, borne on the bier with white and bristly beard, then of thy beauty do I question make, that thou among the wastes of time must go, since sweets and beauties do themselves forsake and die as fast as they see others grow, and nothing against time's scythe can make defense save breed to brave him when he takes thee hence. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 13 by William Shakespeare. Oh, that you were yourself! But love, you are no longer yours, than you yourself here live. Against this coming end you should prepare, and your sweet semblance to some other give. So should that beauty which you hold in lease find no determination, then you were yourself again, after yourself's decease, when your sweet issue your sweet form should bear. Who lets so fair a house fall to decay, which husbandry and honor might uphold against the stormy gusts of winter's day and barren rage of death's eternal cold? Oh, none but unthrifts. Dear my love, you know you had a father. Let your son say so. Literature Out Loud, a Sonnet 14 by William Shakespeare. Not from the stars do I my judgment pluck, and yet methinks I have astronomy, but not to tell of good or evil luck, of plagues, of dearths, or seasons' quality. Nor can I fortune to brief minutes tell, pointing to each his thunder, rain, and wind, or say with princes if it shall go well, by oft predict that I in heaven find. But from thine eyes my knowledge I derive, and constant stars, in them I read such art as truth and beauty shall together thrive. If from thyself to store thou wouldst convert, or else of thee this I prognosticate, thy end is truth's and beauty's doom and date. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 15 by William Shakespeare. When I consider everything that grows, holds in perfection but a little moment, that this huge stage presenteth not but shows whereon the stars in secret influence comment, when I perceive that men as plants increase, cheered and checked even by the selfsame sky, vaunt in their youthful sap, at height decrease, and wear their brave state out of memory, then the conceit of this inconstant stay sets you most rich in youth before my sight, where wasteful time debateth with decay, to change your day of youth to sullied night, and all in war with time for love of you, as he takes from you, I engraft you new. Well, when I think of the abundance in this world, I think of great literature. I feature it here on the program. And then after some editing, I put those pieces on the web available as a podcast. You can listen to anytime, anywhere, always available at danealred.com. I hope your life is as filled with wonder as mine is. I marvel at the abundance of this world. I've recorded 400 different podcasts, complete with text, as we consider number 732 on my list of 1,001 thanks. Potential. Here is a selection from Literature Out Loud, which, for some reason, has been listened to 571 times. Literature Out Loud, The Last Bargain, by Rabindranath Tagore. The Last Bargain. Come and hire me, I cried, while in the morning I was walking on the stone-paved road. Sword in hand, the king came in his chariot. He held my hand and said, I will hire you with my power. But his power counted for naught, and he went away in his chariot. In the heat of the midday, the houses stood with shut doors. I wandered along the crooked lane. An old man came out with his bag of gold. He pondered and said, I will hire you with my money. He weighed his coins one by one, but I turned away. It was evening. The garden hedge was all aflower. The fair maid came out and said, I will hire you with a smile. Her smile paled and melted into tears, and she went back alone into the dark. The sun glistened on the sand, and the sea waves broke waywardly. A child sat playing with shells. He raised his head and seemed to know me and said, I will hire you with nothing.
from thenceforth. That bargain struck in child's play made me a free man.
That piece, along with Grain as Big as a Hen's Egg, are my two most popular pieces in China. I think people are trying to learn English. Unfortunately, they're going to have my accent.
Literature Out Loud, Ozymandias by Percy Bysshe Shelley. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them, and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear, my name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. Literature Out Loud, The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other, as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though, as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet, knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh. Somewhere ages and ages hence, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. The Plotter's Mile, Chapter 7. If I find out someone else has my money, Ray said to himself, pacing the rut that was once the carpet, I'm gonna massage him with the butt of my gun and then shoot him. Ray had decided to stay in town and search the tracks for one more day. There really wasn't a chance of finding the train now, and there was no practical way to search all those miles of tracks. He had also decided to go back to the town where Tommy was being held tomorrow and watch for evidence to be leaked to the press, like it always was in cases like this. Then he might have an idea if the cops had the money, and he could figure out what to do next. Ray hated feeling helpless. It reminded him of the days he'd spent being beat on by his older brothers, who hated being beat by their dad. The pecking order in the Johnson household had ended with him, with the beatings usually getting worse as they were passed down the line. Even when social services had split up the family and sent Ray to foster homes in the hope of a better environment, most of the families he ended up with were in it for the money. They didn't really care about Ray, and they usually had their own kids to prefer to the freeloaders the state had sent. Why would someone else want the kids no one else wanted? Being cheated out of his money just when it was in his grasp, ready to be spent, the golden dreams had been dashed again. Ray was determined that this time he was going to get what was his. And he didn't care who had to get hurt in the meantime. Schmitty had some good advice for Jones. There were a couple of ways to handle the investigation. One was subtle and the other pretty obvious. Jones had decided to do both. He was on the phone with a local television station. Paula Rogers, please. This is Greg Jones. Paula was one of the local reporters who owed Captain Greg Jones a few favors for the quick and reliable information he'd often shared with her. The scoops had made her a local celebrity, and the bigger stations were looking at her for anchor jobs. She knew Greg liked her, and Greg was more than happy to have her attention, if only for his sources. She picked up almost immediately. Greg! You could almost hear the smile over the phone. What have you got for me now? How do you know I'm not calling you up for a date? Said Jones playfully. First, she said, you've never called me up for a date yet. And second, last week when I asked you out, you found some kind of paperwork you had to do. Now Greg was smiling. She was right. He wasn't ready to take that step, but she really wanted him to. He knew she wanted him to, but he just couldn't do it. Even though she'd made it a point of dropping in every week or so, he still couldn't work up the nerve. They'd been on dozens of dates, all of which she had arranged. You're right, I'm a big chicken, he chuckled. So, are you ready for the hot tip of the day? If you really did call me every day, Paula said, then that would really be something to get excited about. Now Jones was blushing. To stop this train of thought in its tracks, he began another conversation about another train. Did you hear about the bank robber they arrested on the train here in town? It was after lunch. John had been able to spend an entire lunch period talking with the guys he regularly ate lunch with without even raising the topic of money, which usually was a favorite topic around the table. John Graham was wondering what he would be able to tell his history classes today that would keep them from sleeping on their desks and would keep him from thinking about that money. Today, they were scheduled to talk about Watergate and other topics from the 70s, but the distraction of his newfound wealth was beginning to cloud every 30 seconds of thought. He decided to just strike out into the subject and see where his subconscious and the kids in class would lead him. So who here knows why we all know Richard Nixon's name? This is Paula Jones with another WGHH exclusive. She was looking especially lovely today, thought Greg as he watched her from the sidelines. Her blonde hair flipped up at the ends and made her look much younger than she was, which he was sure was the desired goal. Greg Jones was a little too shy for his own good, which is probably why he was still single at the ripe old age of 28. He'd been involved with several women, only to be too slow to keep them interested. He had decided it was a personality fault and that it wasn't going to change anytime soon. He was not prepared, however, for the unique patience of Paula Rogers. She'd been burned twice by flashy rich guys. Paula had been engaged twice and had come as close to M-Day minus 1 month until the last year could pull the plug. She had her sights set on Greg Jones, and while he may not have known it, she was ready to be as patient as was necessary to catch this one. Though she was younger than Greg by a few years, she had much more wisdom than him when it came to catching a mate. She smiled and looked over at Greg. Local Ridgeway Police Captain Greg Jones has been credited with recovering some of the $100,000 stolen 2 days ago from the First National Bank in DeLand, she intoned without a pause, hitch or hiccup. Though all of the money has not been recovered, Captain Jones has been recognized by the state authorities for his quick response. Investigations will continue while officers inspect the money that was found for fingerprints. Greg was always amazed at the calmness with which Paula delivered the news, even when it involved grisly details. She was a pro. She was looking into the camera to wrap it up. We'll keep you up to date with any new developments here at WGHH, and this has been another Paula Jones exclusive. She always rapped with that same tagline, even when it wasn't a story exclusive to her. She had explained it to Greg, only Paula Jones can have a Paula Jones exclusive. It made the viewers think they were getting information they couldn't get at another station, and it was one of the reasons her network had been rated number one since shortly after her arrival. It was the main reason so many other stations wanted Paula Jones to work for them. Paula handed the microphone off and took Greg by the elbow and ushered him off to their own little private corner of the office while the camera crew packed up. So how was that, boss? Greg could feel himself beginning to redden. Thanks, Paula. That was exactly what I needed. We want whoever robbed the bank to come and try to get the rest of this money. Paula looked concerned. Doesn't that put you in danger? I mean, she said, taking both his hands and pulling him to face her. Won't that robber come armed and dangerous? Well, probably, but I don't think he'll come in demanding the money, Greg explained, pulling her hands down to his side. We think he'll just want to find out where it is, and then we can catch him trying to take it. We'll put some surveillance on the office. I shouldn't be in danger, but I think I can handle myself. I'm a big, strong man, after all, you know. He puffed up his chest. She took the invitation to lean over and tousle his hair with the other hand pressed on his chest. I know you can handle yourself. I'm just wondering if you can handle a dinner with a friendly reporter. Greg blushed now. She was always able to throw him off his guard just when he thought he was in control. He liked it. Sure, let's go to the T-bone, he said, and took her hand, leading her out the door. That was Chapter 7 from my crime novel, The Plotter's Mile. You can listen to the entire book and read along at my website, danealred.com, or 1001thanks.com, along with other 500 other podcasts with text. If you can't wait, look it up online. My crime mystery will keep you turning page after page or podcast after podcast. Isn't this a great world? We live in times only dreamt of by all the people of the past. Right now, I'm speaking to all the world, and you can listen live on the internet or at your convenience by podcast. How can I proclaim abundance and not share with what I have been blessed with? I'm healthy, I'm active, I'm able to contribute to the world. I do the show every Sunday night. I've been in commercials, television, and film, and I do live performances every year. I'm happily married. I have two great kids and four terrific grandchildren. I hope your life is just as wonderful. Thank you for joining me for this episode of Abundance. Proclaim the abundance of your life. Tell those you love, I love you. Contemplate your blessings. Look in your life for those who need your help. Keep the positive attitude of abundance no matter the opposition from the world. And though I am grateful, you are here to bless this world.